Welcome to Heads and Tails. My name is David Smelly. Heads and Tails is going to be a series of podcast interviews with business leaders about anything other than the law. Today, I'm delighted to kick off the series by speaking to Lord Brown of Madingley, one of the most respected British businessmen of the last century, but much more than that, an accomplished author, philanthropist, advisor to government, and passionate supporter of the arts. John, welcome, and thank you very much for agreeing to kick off our series.
It's a pleasure.
Today, John, I want to really focus on a subject which has played such a large role in your life, energy. It's past, present, and future. But to start off, I'd just like to focus on oil and gas. And I just want to ask you, what is it about oil and gas that drew you into the industry in the first place? And what about it has so fascinated you through your career?
What drew me in the first instance was it was a place where there were problems and challenges to be solved that nobody else had met and solved. So it was exciting. Things had to be done differently, and I felt I was solving problems that no one else had met, and I was doing it for the first time. That was very exciting. But as time went by, of course, the most exciting thing about oil and gas as the principal sources of energy when I joined the oil industry was the combination of geopolitics, engineering, commerce, markets, people, and risk. And it was an enormously intoxicating cocktail of things to be challenged with. I couldn't think of anything else which was more challenging. And of course, more necessary, because energy keeps the world going around. I mean, there's nothing you could do unless you had a continuous, reliable, and lowest possible cost source of energy.
And of course, your father was in the oil industry, wasn't he?
He was. It was his third career, I think. And then he was in the oil industry, was in Iran and in Masjid-i Suleiman, where I used to go for two school vacations a year. And I still remember the roar of the flares, because natural gas at the time was valueless, and so people burnt it. You imagine doing that nowadays, burning it for no reason and producing all that carbon dioxide. And the roar of the flares and the smell of the sulfur, the smell of the oil. Nowadays, that would be absolutely out of the question to allow all those gases to escape. But I remember it. It was a very exciting combination. I remember also going around the oil fields and seeing oil wells being drilled and some of the old original equipment that was used to discover the first oil in the Zagros foothills, which opened up the great adventure that eventually became BP.
So there's obviously, John, the engineer in you and the adventurer in you actually loves, I sense, the front line of oil and gas production, you know, the machinery, the extraction and things like that. But from your career, you know, in 1984, you commenced a series of leadership roles which culminated in you becoming Group Chief Executive of BP until 2007. What was it, I wonder, which excited you as much about running big businesses as you had found about frontline oil and gas exploration and production?
Well, I spent, of course, the first decade of my career being an engineer, and I loved that. And then I went to business school, and actually before that, I was working in the US, and I began to realize that engineers could do more than just engineering. They could actually take the product of what they were doing and take it into the commercial space. And that was very much a US tradition that was not a UK tradition, whereas it was always in the hands of financiers and things like that. But actually, engineers in the US ran big businesses. So I went to business school and I realized that the combination of what I'd been doing and what needed to be done to make a business was very exciting indeed. And I felt that this is something I wanted to do more and more of. And the oil and gas industry, again, was something that offered me the possibility. Obviously, even at that time, it was the late 70s, early 80s, I was in Silicon Valley. Even then, the beginnings of the great entrepreneurial activity happened. I remember Steve Jobs coming to speak to my class. In those days, he wore bell-bottom jeans, and I think he was in the no-washing phase, and sat on a big desk holding an apple. And it was all very exciting, what was going on, and I nearly stayed, because I was just intrigued with the people who were building businesses from nothing. And that stayed with me. And I said to myself, if I stay with a big company, I'm going to figure out how to make decisions quickly and how to make them as exciting as the activities that these people were undertaking.
Well, fantastic recollections. And actually, John, logically, that leads me to my next question, because in 1997, you pioneered BP's shift towards an environmental focus, famously encapsulated by the phrase beyond petroleum. What was it that drove that shift, and why did you see it at the time as so important?
I think the shift in my mind had started a long time ago. I remember when I was working in Alaska, the thing that disturbed me most of all, this was in the late 60s, early 70s, was people fishing with dynamite. I couldn't believe that people were actually doing this. And also driving four-wheel trucks around the tundra, only to find that the next year where they'd driven was a lake. And this is all kind of wrong. And when I was working on the West Coast of America, I realized that actually people were doing things that were beginning to correct some of the industrial mistakes of the US. And certainly when I was at Stanford, it was the beginnings of a sense that actually, after Silent Spring, Rachel Carson's book, things really had to change. And the scandals of environmental despoilation were things that we had to change. So come back to the 90s. When I took over as a CEO of BP, I was very interested to try and understand what was going on this very big debate at the time about global warming. This was post the Rio conference in 1993. And it was very clear that the data, which was not perfect at the time, was showing that what we were doing as humans was changing the balance of things. You know, CO2 was being, carbon dioxide was being generated, and more was being generated than could be absorbed by the Earth and its atmosphere. And so it was changing the way in the future, that the temperature of the world would work, and that would affect the climate almost everywhere, would change circulation. And so there was enough evidence to at least take precautionary steps against this. You know, why wouldn't you if there was danger on the horizon? So we then started working inside BP to see what could be done practically, because it's all very well saying these things, you actually have to do something about it. So we worked out a plan whereby we would first put a price on carbon and trade it internally so that we would realize that there's a cost to generating CO2. It's an externality, and you had to pay for it, at least internally. Secondly, to substitute energy which is made by fossil fuel with renewable energy. Thirdly, to stop methane, that's natural gas, being leaking into the atmosphere, because nowadays, we know it's 80 times more powerful than carbon dioxide over a 20-year period. So it's a very powerful greenhouse gas, and you have to bottle it up. And so we tightened all the valves and things like that. And so those were important things. And what was interesting was how strongly the staff felt about this. 80% of them said, this is what we need to do.
Yeah.
We don't come to work just to make money. We come to work to do something good as well. And that was very important. And my deputy at the time always said to me, you know, the thing that people are not motivated by is an extra 2 pennies on the stock price. They really aren't. Said, you know, maybe the investors are, but actually the staff here are motivated by doing something great. And so when we announced that, so I stood up at Stanford University in 97 and said, on behalf of the company, the oil and gas industry is a problem. It is producing a lot of CO2 through its products, and that changing the climate, and we now need to be part of the solution. And I would like to be at the table with other people who are discussing my future. And that's what we wanted to do. And here's the plan. So I think the team inside BP loved that. The oil industry hated it. And it was my first real run-in with the American Petroleum Institute. There were several others who said, you know, you've left the church and you can't say that. And it's all against our lobbying. And I said, but it's actually the way we think. And, you know, maybe we'll pull out of the API. Eventually, we couldn't pull out of the API, but I wish we had. And they continued to say, well, it's uncertain, it's probably not right, and nothing happens, and this, that, and the other. A lot of nonsense. We were very heavily criticized by the industry and actually supported by NGOs and by the staff. Mm-hmm. And we stuck with it while I was CEO of BP. We decided to have this strap line, which, because we'd merged with Amoco and Arco and Castrol and all sorts of people. Yeah. So we had lots of brands and we needed one logo, one identifier. So we changed the Helios, the brand mark that now is BP, and we wanted the strap line. So we said it's Beyond Petroleum, because we thought that this is psychologically where we were. Our thinking was what to do beyond petroleum. And of course, people played with that hugely. They said, oh, well, you know, they're going to get out of the oil industry, oil and gas production business. And I said, that's a bit too early in those days. We started a trend. I'm very pleased we did. I think we made investments in renewable energy at the time, which were the best we could do at the time, but they were too early. It was probably a bad business decision. It was a good philosophical decision, a good trends decision. And it's better than what I think people now call virtue signaling. You know, where people say, it's really good that we should stop producing oil and gas and do nothing about it. That's virtue signaling with no delivery.
Yeah.
My view is, if we said something, we had to deliver. And we delivered some of that incorrectly. But time went on and it got better and better.
So the years since 97 have proved that strategic shift right. And I just wonder, what's the future for oil and gas?
Well, I think the shift is definitely happening now.
Yeah.
And I'm pleased to see that even the most recalcitrant of the large companies, ExxonMobil, has come around in some ways. In fact, they've had some people appointed to their board that doubtless will encourage them to come around significantly. So oil and gas still has a future, there's no doubt. Transitioning the world's energy system cannot happen overnight. Clearly, we need to get rid of generating carbon dioxide and letting methane leak into the atmosphere. We have to do that. So that's the objective. What do we do to get rid of emissions? Now, what is creating emissions is not renewable energy, and that will expand, and it's expanding hugely, but it can't expand fast enough to take out oil and gas for quite a long time. And maybe we'll be consuming 70% of what we're consuming today, even in 10 years' time, and it will drop over time. So there's a future for it for a long time. Certainly oil and then gas, it will go down. It is X growth. It is without a doubt X growth, but it's there. And I think, you know, remember please that most of oil and gas is produced not by the companies we know and recognize like Exxon and Shell and BP and Total, and people like that, but by state-owned companies like Saudi Aramco, Petronas, Equinor, even in Norway, to name but a few. And these people are the people who will produce the last barrels of oil and gas over time. And slowly, the sort of quoted sector, if you will transform itself either into simply a yield-paying company where they'll be, you know, they'll be depleting themselves and distributing cash, or they will diversify and successfully change themselves into energy businesses which are not based on fossil fuels. That, I think, will take a lot of time. No one should imagine that's going to happen overnight. And it will be an open question for investors who really always worry about companies doing one thing, converting themselves into doing something else. It's you know, diversification of that sort is dangerous. And so investors want to see who can do it well. And the jury's out at the moment. So the big oil and gas companies still producing lots of oil and gas.
And what do you think the effect of the pandemic will be on this process?
Well, it's always difficult to say. It's actually too early to tell, I think. The pandemic, without any doubt, reduced the demand for energy, and it changed the pattern of energy consumption a bit on the margin. You know, more and more energy will be converted into a secondary form of energy called electricity, which is going to power things like vehicles, electric vehicles. It will power the mining of Bitcoin, as we know, even from Elon Musk's statements, it's been well known for some time, and more data centers. But that is growing. But what really happened during the pandemic is no one traveled by air and less vehicle miles. I think that was going to come back. You know, maybe not come back wholly, but it will come back over time. And I think the market is presently trying to figure out just the rate of recovery, but it will recover to an extent. I would hope that some of it's permanently substituted. For example, when we fly, I think it's going to be quite difficult to develop a hydrogen-based aeroplane or an electricity-based aeroplane to go over reasonably long distances. So the fuel that will go into those will be biofuels or synthetic fuels, which will not be based on fossil fuels, but based on zero carbon inputs. And it's good to see that that's now beginning to come into the system.
And so, John, what about your future?
Well, I think I certainly fail in my at least conceptual idea that I might retire one day. I think I probably won't. I want to keep a nice balance between, you know, business and philanthropy, government activity and the arts. So in business, a lot of what I do now is involved with climate. I'm a senior advisor to General Atlantic on sustainability and climate. And I hope that, and I know that actually that will develop into a big idea of investing, but more of that later. Because I do think, again, what we say about climate has to be followed by action on climate at whatever scale. And the world needs to invest, you know, huge amounts of money to basically transform the whole of industry. That's what climate change needs. The whole of industry needs to be transformed. So that's about, you know, $3.5 trillion a year. I won't be investing that amount, but if I could think of maybe $3.5 billion or something like that, you know, then you can begin to make a little bit of a difference. And but I think it's much more worthwhile than just saying things. So I'm also investing in technology. I've been doing that for some time. I sit on the boards of various companies. I still sit on the board of a renewable energy company, and I sit on the board of an AI company. So lots of exciting, I find this very exciting because the people are different and they have different backgrounds. They tend to be younger than I am. At my age, I tend to be the oldest person around, but I love being challenged by people who have much better ideas for the future. So that's the business side. On the government side, it's primarily about engineering and science. I'm co-chairman of, independent co-chairman of the Council on Science and Technology, which advises the Prime Minister in the UK. And I'm the board of UK Research and Innovation. And I take great interest in what's going on in research and innovation, in particular in innovation, how you get it out of the lab and into the market. That's very exciting. And it's an area where the UK isn't the best. It's the best in the lab. It's not so good in getting it out of the lab into great commerce. And I want to make sure that the UK gets better at that. I'm involved in art, obviously, still. I used to be chairman of the Tate. I'm now chairman of the Courtauld Institute of Art. We're renovating our great gallery where we'll show Samuel Courtauld's collection, the greatest collection of Impressionist paintings in the world. It was interesting when we were closed, we sent it to France to be viewed, and in 3 months, 500,000 people were to go and see it, which is, it shows you, even in France, with all the richness of the Quai d'Orsay, you know, people went to see the bar at the Folies Bergères and the Déjeuner Solaire and all these sorts of things. I'm excited to do support with, I've got a charitable trust of my own, which is beginning to support more and more people, more and more things. It supports excellence where nobody else is prepared to go. So we support people primarily so they can strive for excellence, but it's surprising how many of those people are not supported by other charities. So I do that, and I support, obviously, the organizations that I'm involved in if they make sense charitably. So we've been, it's gave me great pleasure only a month ago to announce that I'm supporting a college in Cambridge called Murray Edwards with a significant benefaction to build by a building, which will be named in honor of my late mother. And great.
No, fantastic. So, John, thank you so much. I've got three quick questions to finish with. Yeah. First, your best business decision.
Oh, without a doubt, buying Amoco and making the world's first super major.
Your worst business decision.
Oh, without a doubt, buying all those wind properties at the time when they were a financial disaster.
And your favorite piece of art.
Well, it has to be something I own. I prefer to something I own rather than something someone else owns. So I have a most wonderful collection. I think it's there's only one or two in private hands, maybe only one, of woodcuts made by Titian, of the parting of the Red Sea. It's monumental. It's in 12 panels of Abraham and Isaac in four panels, and the conversion of St. Paul in four panels. These are great woodcuts. I get to see them every day, and they're absolutely my favorite part of my collection.
John, Lord Brown, thank you so much for being on this podcast with me. It's been a great conversation, and we wish you all the best for your future in all the different areas, and we wait to hear what happens on the General Atlantic front.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.